Welcome to the monthly meeting of the Humanist Union of Madison. Today we're delighted to have Norman Stockwell speaking to us. In July, Norman Stockwell took on the role of publisher of the Progressive magazine after spending more than 30 years at WORT Community Radio, the last 21 years as their operations coordinator. While at WORT, he covered national and international issues with radio reports, print articles and talk programs. His reports and interviews have appeared on Free Speech Radio News, Democracy Now!, Air America, and in print in the Capital Times, Alternate, the Tico Times, Toward Freedom, and elsewhere. He is co-editor of the book Rebel Reporting, John Ross Speaks to Independent Journalists. And you may have seen him on the stage at Fighting Bob Fest. And he has played an important role behind the scenes there, providing me, for example, with the audio recordings I've used to broadcast the talks of the speakers there on WRDE. Countries his reporting and media work have taken to include Canada, Cuba, Mexico, Brazil, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Kenya, Senegal, and Tunisia to report on such things as world social forums and presidential elections in some of those countries. Welcome, Norm.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here. Obviously, right now, the things that we say today may all change in the weeks to come. There's a lot of flux in our political system. There's a recount going on right now in Wisconsin. Another one coming in Michigan, another one in Pennsylvania. It's probably unlikely that those recounts will change the ultimate outcome of the election, but it's certainly possible. The electoral vote was not as overwhelming as one would think, hearing the president-elect speak about it. And he lost the popular vote by more than 2 million votes. In our states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, even before the recount started, a number of overvotes were identified. In the case of Pennsylvania, something like 27,000. In the case of Wisconsin, about 5,000. And so the vote totals in the three states combined are only about 70,000 different right now between the two candidates. I think that what we saw in this past week with Donald Trump beginning what he calls his victory lap with a rally in Ohio is really in some ways a victory prep on his part. That is that he wants to make sure that his base remains mobilized so that if there were any question arising out of these recounts about his legitimacy, that he would have people to defend his right to ascend to the presidency. So I think it's unlikely that we will see a change in the direction that that's going. And so rather what we have to do is to sort of take a look, assess the situation, how did we get here, and what are we going to do in the months and years to come. It's pretty clear that in the inner circle of the Trump potential administration, let's call it, there are sort of two competing agendas. On the one hand, a group of people that identify with what they call the alt-right, what others have more accurately perhaps named the white supremacist right, and their goal is to secure leadership, to secure power in the American political system for the next couple of generations. And they're moving their chess pieces in order to try and make sure that that takes place. The the symbols of that, I guess, if you can see, one was the change in the transition team itself. When Chris Christie was bumped off the transition team and replaced by Indiana Governor Mike Pence. And immediately you saw an effort to sort of build a circle around Donald Trump of advisors, potential cabinet posts that would make sure that Donald Trump's unpredictability did not affect their agenda as they moved forward in this attempt to establish and secure political power. On the other side, you have the millionaires and billionaires that Donald Trump is bringing into the administration. And it seems like, for the most part, their agenda is to loot as much from the country as they can in as swift a manner as possible. It's interesting when you look at the trajectory of the wealthy right in this country over the past century. What you see is back in the beginning of the early 20th century, the notion was for a rich capitalist to build an empire which they would hand down to their children. What we've seen starting in the 1980s in the era of Ronald Reagan is a sort of a slash and burn mentality of basically, if you'll pardon the theft of an advertising phrase, grabbing for all the gusto you can with the notion that it's not going to be around to hand down to your children anyway. And we saw that in the Reagan administration era, when you actually had the president himself saying, Armageddon may come in our lifetime. And so these two strains are competing in the Trump administration, the looters, the slash and burn people who want to get as much as they can out of the system. And the way you'll see that manifest itself is in terms of privatization, attacks on things like Medicare, Obamacare, and so on, as well as school privatization represented through the woman who's been chosen for Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, who is a strong proponent of charter schools and school privatization. But you'll see that attempts at privatizing public services and public good, sort of dismantling the so-called welfare state, but I would really say dismantling the gains of the last 50 or 60 years. On the other side, you have people that are working to secure power so that they can continue to control, and those people are willing to make various political bargains in exchange for securing their power. And that's where we see things like the backpedaling on building the wall, the backpedaling on getting a special prosecutor to go after Hillary Clinton, the backpedaling on so many of the campaign promises that we heard in the last 18 months. Also, you see it in terms of the maneuvering of relations. For instance, the phone conversation that Donald Trump had with the president of Taiwan, the first time that a U.S. president has spoken with a leader of Taiwan in, I forget how many years, but certainly the last four or five presidencies. And so what we see is this ultra-right sector trying to make sure that they can secure power and be able to hand it down. And it'll be interesting, many people have speculated that Donald Trump won't even finish out his first term as president, that either because of indictment, because of conflict of interest, or because he simply gets bored with it and walks away, like the kid that says, I'm taking my bat and ball and I'm going home. If, in fact, that were to take place and Mike Pence were to rise to the presidency, the person that he then chooses for his vice presidential nominee would be a very good sign of this attempt to secure power long term. And some names have already been floated, one being Sarah Palin, another one being Paul Ryan. I think the Paul Ryan one would actually be more dangerous in some ways.
He's and smarter than Sarah Palin.
And what we can see there is an attempt to sort of set up a dynasty almost of inheritance, where you would have Mike Pence, who's fairly young, who could serve two terms, maybe two and a half as president. And then you have a Paul Ryan, who could then go on, who's even younger, and take another round. So it's very frightening in that way. How do we respond? The title of this talk is How Do Progressives and the Progressive Respond? Our organization, the Progressive Magazine, is right now 107 years old. We're going to turn 108 in about a month. And our role throughout has been to be a voice of the progressive movement in the United States, beginning with fighting Bob La Follette back in the early 20th century, and going through the fight against Joe McCarthy in the 1950s, the opposition to the Vietnam War in the 1960s, the opposition to the wars in Central America in the 1980s, and the Iraq War in the 2000s. And so one of the things that we did, our editor Ruth Conniff, who's been with the magazine for a long, long time, she's editor-in-chief now of the magazine, put together a little handout, which I brought some of, I'll pass out to you. It's called 8 Things That You Can Do to Uphold Progressive Values in 2017. And I thought we would walk through those. The first one is come out as a progressive. If people remember the attack on Michael Dukakis when he ran for president back in 1988, I think it was. History is drifting here. 88. When Michael Dukakis ran for president, the attack on him was, oh, he's a card-carrying liberal. He's a member of the ACLU. And he sort of, you know, hunkered down and said, oh, I'm not a liberal. And of course, what he should have done is he should have put, well, yes, I am. Here's my card. Where is yours? This is about what it means to be an American. So item one, come out as a card-carrying progressive. Number two has to do with the incredible protests that are going on right now in North Dakota against the pipeline there at Standing Rock Reservation. And this is not just about a small group of Native Americans. This protest has brought together people from around the globe. It's the largest gathering of tribes in recent memory. And now, as of this weekend, a number of veterans have gone to form a human shield around the people that have been there since, in some cases, since the spring, certainly since the summer. And it's about long-term protecting the water, the Missouri River that will flood, or that serves all, you know, what, I forget the numbers now, 30,000 people or something in that Missouri River Valley.
And it does go to the Mississippi.
Goes to the Mississippi too from there, right. It's also about fossil fuels and the idea that these extractive industries and getting these very expensive, very dirty tar sands oil in order to support our fossil fuel economy is something that we need to move away from. And the whole history of environmental racism in this country, where in this particular case, the pipeline originally was going to go through a populated area of North Dakota, and the white residents didn't want it there. And so they said, fine, we'll move it here to where these Native people live that nobody cares about. And you see that happening over and over again, whether it be more recently Flint, Michigan, or historically some of the toxic waste in the South and the Southeast.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm forgetting my question. Go on.
Okay.
I'll think of my question.
Number three, showing solidarity with immigrants and Muslim Americans. We've seen in recent months, the last 18 or so now, attacks on people living in this country with or without legal status. You saw Donald Trump come out against a judge just because his parents happens to be Mexican, the judge, an American citizen. You've seen this threat that all Muslims would have to register. And of course, here in the United States, we actually have a rich history of Muslims living in this country going back to the earliest days of the United States. We have Keith Ellison in the House of Representatives, a Muslim from the state of Minnesota.
Wasn't the first mosque built out in North or South Dakota?
North Dakota.
It was North Dakota? Yeah, I heard that the first, and there was a settlement of Muslims back. I can't remember how far back. I know the question I have on Native Americans.
Yes.
Now. Do you think that Obama is doing enough to help the Native Americans in Standing Rock? And do you think Donald will do anything? I won't call him president or president.
I think several things to that question. I think that as with so many things, I think that President Obama is too little too late, that he could have intervened much, much earlier in this. In fact, as president, he's responsible for the Army Corps of Engineers, for the FAA, which is now, which regulates the airspace, and now the police there are shooting down the drones that the protesters have been using to take pictures of the police there. I think that throughout his career as president, unfortunately, even though he has been a spokesperson for the notion of more sustainable energy, he has also, as president, supported these pipelines. And so I think that's problematic. I think that Donald Trump has very clearly said that he's in favor of pipelines, of oil exploration, of extractive industries in general. And I would not be surprised if a Donald Trump presidency was worse rather than better for the situation in Standing Rock.
I saw a report yesterday that he's an investor in that pipeline.
Yeah.
He's an investor in a company.
Do you think that when he becomes president, that he will tell the police to be more active towards the protesters, and therefore violence could.
Well, I think we've already seen tremendous violence being used against the protesters, and mostly at the behest of the governor of the state of North Dakota, Governor Dalrymple, as well as the county sheriff in that area. I think that. That again is something where the president could have intervened early on and has not. It's hard to predict what Donald Trump will or won't do when he is actually in the White House, because so much of what he does is unpredictable, but there's no question that the people around him all represent the interests that favor moving forward with the pipeline. Moving on to number four, embrace a nasty woman. Of course, people heard the phrase that Donald Trump used about Hillary Clinton as a nasty woman, which immediately generated a lot of t-shirts and sweatshirts and so on. The attempts right now by the Trump and Pence administration, even before they're in office, to move an agenda of defunding Planned Parenthood. The firm commitment of Governor Pence of Indiana against a woman's right to choose is well established. Donald Trump's is less clear. But supporting women's rights, and particularly the right to choose, is very important in this time. Number five, make sure the world knows that Black lives still matter. More and more we've seen a militarization of local police, attacks on African Americans in communities across the country, and it still continues. Even though the videos of these incidents are circulating all over the internet, the United Nations has ruled that the United States is in violation of the rights of these people, and yet it continues. The militarization of the police, much of it sort of a byproduct of the Iraq War, because all of this equipment that was purchased for use in Iraq is now coming home and finding its home in our cities. Across the country, there are movements to create citizen accountability, citizen review of the actions of local police. Even more than that, there is a movement to create better training of the police. And our own David Cooper, police chief in Madison for many years, as well as Norm Stamper, the former police chief in Seattle, have both come out with books talking about how police training could be done in such a different way. And you do see when it happens in non-minority communities, if it's a white college kid that's drunk and threatening the police, the chance of a violent response is significantly decreased.
How do you feel about the police department in Madison?
The Madison Police Department, just like all the other police departments in the country, has received a lot of this military equipment. They have this, what they call an MRAP vehicle, one of these high-tech vehicles that they use now in hostage situations, they say is what it's for. But of course, you know, when you've got it, you use it, just like saying if you have a hammer, you're always going around looking for a nail. I think that there's always been a culture in police forces of protecting their own, and so we saw that in the case of some of these investigations that took place. Tony Robinson and earlier the Polly Heenan incident, and also the young woman in the mall not too long ago, where the police union, which might, in some cases take a more progressive stand, closes ranks to protect the individuals. And you understand that, because these are people that are putting their lives on the line in many cases. But you also have this this culture of demonizing certain people, certain groups of people, that filters into the consciousness of the department. And that's where some of the training that David Cooper brought to the police force back in the 70s could well be used now. But a lot of those officers that trained under Cooper are now retiring, and so it's a new generation of police that haven't had the benefit of some of that training and de-escalation.
Do you think the fact that there are more women in the police force now that has helped at all?
Well, there's certainly, Madison went through a period where it didn't have any women on the force or on the fire department, and there was a great effort to get more and more women on both the police force and in the fire department, and I think that's a very good thing. I think that again, the overall training and the overall culture of the force is something that needs to be looked at in a holistic way. And I would refer to David Cooper's book, Arrested Development, where he talks about the efforts that he went through to basically scale down the response that police were in Madison were having towards protesters back in the early 1970s. Going on through our list, number six, keep fighting for economic justice. Bernie Sanders' campaign certainly showed that people are very, very concerned about the 1%, about the millionaires and billionaires that control the majority of the wealth in this country. The movement that's working very hard against that, the Fight for 15 movement, working for a $15 an hour minimum wage, has had great success around the country. We've seen it in a number of cities, and we've also seen it in several industries now where the $15 minimum wage has been taken up. Just was a couple days ago, there was national demonstrations by the Fight for 15 folks. So that's certainly something to support. And then showing kindness. You know, we have there's so much hatefulness in the world right now. We need to get involved in organizations that support love and tolerance and community values. And some of those are groups working on local issues, homelessness, food banks. Then there's also building community with groups like this that get together and talk about these issues. And then finally, Ruth's eighth point, get out of your comfort zone. That we're going to have to make our politics better and build a mass movement that means that we reach out to each other and that we understand where the other person is coming from, that we don't let ourselves get siloed into these Facebook groups where we're all talking to people that talk just like us, that rather we interact with and appreciate the situations that others are in, and also share with them our values. If you're on a subway car and you see somebody abusing a Muslim woman wearing a hijab, you can say something. You can respond to that. This is happening on college campuses across the country. It's happening in cities, and it's even happening here in Madison. There have been incidents. There was at Edgewood College right over here a note stuck on the door of the gender and women's studies department. At the UW, there have been incidents of swastika graffiti appearing. A lot of the people with these mean attitudes. I was at the Republican convention in Cleveland, and what I felt was really there's a lot of meanness in the hallways there. A lot of people with these mean attitudes are feeling emboldened by the fact that their candidate won the election. And so you're seeing a lot of incidents now of people saying, you know, our guy won and you're going to have to, you know, suck it up and get over it. And, you know, in many cases with people whose heritage comes from other countries, they're being told you're going to have to move out and go back to your own country, wherever that may be. So we need to confront that as individuals on a day-to-day basis. If you see something, say something is the motto of the Homeland Security people, but I think it should be our motto as well. So those are Ruth's eight points. Trying to look at some hopeful things we can do in response to a time that is, I'm afraid, going to be very dark for a while. We just came out with our new issue of the magazine with a rather dark and foreboding cover. But in the magazine, you have both stories of concern, but also stories of success and stories of people working to respond to these things. And so I brought some of those along for everybody to grab. And if you're already a subscriber, take one anyway and share it with a friend.
Okay.
And then...
in connection with the point six and Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has the Our Revolution movement going. Can you talk about that? Are they creating local chapters? Or
So basically, the Bernie Sanders campaign was obviously an amazing, amazing phenomenon in so many ways. I mean, he was the oldest person to ever run for president of the United States. When he started his campaign, he was older than Ronald Reagan was when he started his campaign, and yet Ronald Reagan is the one that, at least in the current memory, we think of as, you know, the grandfatherly president. But Bernie Sanders was the oldest candidate to ever run for president, and yet he mobilized more of the youth than I think almost any other candidate, except maybe Barack Obama in 2008. And coming out of the defeat in the Democratic convention, Bernie Sanders said he was going to put his efforts behind supporting Hillary Clinton to make sure that Donald Trump didn't get elected. And he did that. But at the same time, he put a lot of the energy and motion of his campaign into creating this new organization called Our Revolution. And the notion is to have statewide chapters across the country in all 50 states, and to have those statewide chapters use their political muscle, which usually comes in the form of mailing lists and money, to use their political muscle to support local progressive candidates. One of the problems that we have across the country, and Wisconsin is a prime example of it, is that there's not a very deep bench of potential candidates. We saw that when the Democratic Party of Wisconsin was trying to find a candidate to run against Scott Walker for governor in the recall. There's not a lot of potential candidates out there because we have not, as progressives, worked on developing that pool of people. The right has been much more successful in rising up through the ranks of school board and city council and county board and state representatives and so on to populate their field with candidates. So the Our Revolution people are starting in different states, and it's happening in different ways. There's a group here in Wisconsin that's been organizing. And the notion is to support progressive political candidates in the coming election, which will be the midterm election, will be a chance to roll back some of the gains that the right made in this past election. We saw in 2010, similarly, the Republicans took that strategy and were able to gain control of a lot of state legislatures and governorships and so on. That was when we got Scott Walker and lost Russ Feingold in Wisconsin.
Do you think that the term revolution is an unfortunate one? I do. I think it's going to turn people off who would very much be in favor of the same things that Bernie is talking about, but the word revolution has some very unfortunate connotations. People manning the barricades and throwing bombs and stuff. It's a,
well, I talk about political revolution.
Yeah, well, I understand that, but you're, but I think I'm that, afraid there are people who will say, people of my generation,
or
younger.
Bernie Sanders chose to appropriate that term during his campaign, just as he chose to appropriate the term socialism, which has had such a negative connotation in the United States over the last several decades, at least. An interesting story. My grandfather was a missionary in West China. And at the time of the revolution in China in 1949, he was imprisoned, as were other missionaries. and he was in the prison, and there were two people that would share a cell. And the Chinese word for revolution is fan shen, which means turn over. But for him, what that word meant was that every day the guard would come in, and the two people in the cell shared a mattress. And the guard would come in and he would say, it's time to fan shen, it's time to turn over the mattress. And the other guy got the mattress then, because it was turned over under his head. And so revolution has a lot of different meanings. And
just means the earth turning around.
But Bernie Sanders chose that term for better or for worse. And But it's certainly, I think it's true that in a lot of ways we do need a revolution in values in this country, to quote Martin Luther King from 1967. And if that can come from a movement, a grassroots movement of everyday people working to create change, all the better.
We certainly have a major gathering of progressives every year at Fighting Bob Fest. Have any idea what kind of speakers we're going to see this coming year?
This coming year is a long way off, and we haven't talked about it yet, but I have to say that during the past 8 years, the attendance at Fighting Bob Fest has declined because there wasn't a symbolic negative leader in the White House, and the attendance was at its highest during the administration of George W. Bush. So I think that probably the attendance at Fighting Bob Fest this coming year will definitely be stimulated to grow by the new occupant in the White House. I think that it's going to be incumbent upon us to get speakers there who not only lead cheers, but also help build grassroots organizing.
Is it going to be in Madison at Bree Stevens again?
Chances are.
Okay, good.
If all things stay the same, it will be.
Send an invitation to Obama.
We'll see what he's doing. We'll see what he's doing by then.
Coming on, and a lot of people invited him to the protests. He didn't come all the way.
Well, he was busy then. He'll be free now.
Yeah.
Let's see, 2 points. So they keep saying they don't have somebody to run against Annette Ziegler. Is that another example of how nobody can find anybody to run?
I think that particularly here in Wisconsin, but I think around the country, I think what we've found is that there has not been a good effort placed on developing candidates. That people who have been chosen to run for various offices often are chosen because they think they have access to funds to be able to pay for the campaign. And it doesn't seem like that's a good way to develop leadership. But our political system in this country has become so tied to the cost of advertising. In William Proxmire's last run for the Senate in Wisconsin, he spent $70 on his reelection campaign.
A lot of that was because he had to have postage to mail back contributions.
Yeah. In Senate campaign recently of Tammy Baldwin and Tommy Thompson, it was five-figure in the millions.
So. Well, part of it was getting the word out. I mean, even in Madison, let's see, 92.1 switched to Christmas music full-time.
Right.
And then just last week, I think, we heard the Rainbow Bookstore was shut up. And if that's happening in Madison, which is fairly liberal, we had Mike McCabe the other month, who was basically saying that, a lot of the real people he talks to, they'll vote values, and if there are any facts disagree with it, they'll throw out the facts, and not the values, which is, for me. So, lot of it seemed to be, I mean, we got the Progressive and Hightower's magazine, which we can send out to people, but is there any way of really getting good information? I mean, so far we have...
Well, I think, I mean, I think that...
radio program for radio.
Yeah, no, I think that, I think you touch on a very important point. One of the strategies of the right has been to defund and depopulate left and liberal organizations. And so what you've seen over the past couple of decades is a concerted campaign that works in a couple of different ways. The attack on collective bargaining here in Wisconsin also resulted in fewer union members, which meant fewer bodies doing telephone calling, walking the streets, dropping literature, and so on, because the unions were a strong ally of Democratic political candidates. What you've seen in terms of local contributions to things, when all of the federal money was going to military adventures in Iraq and Afghanistan, it meant that states received less federal money, which meant that counties received less federal money, which meant that cities received less federal money. And you had parents in schools doing a bake sale to raise money to buy textbooks for the classrooms when all of that money was being sent instead over to bomb people in Iraq. So those kinds of things have been very detrimental, but also the attacks on media. And since that's an area where I have traveled for many years, I will speak to that a little bit. In terms of public radio, public television, community radio, a lot of funding for those, the more established stations, comes from a thing called the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Corporation for Public Broadcasting was created in 1967 as a method to help support public broadcasting and keep it insulated from the political whims. And yet their funds have to be distributed by Congress. And so you've seen attacks on that funding. Newt Gingrich led a very prominent attack in 1995. The CPB is funded 2 years in advance, but under the George W. Bush administration, he was the first president ever to use a thing called rescission, where he actually took back money that had already been allocated in a budget cut, and they blamed it on the attempts to balance the federal budget. Right now, the CPB is anticipating a 50% funding cut under the new administration.
Ouch.
The goal, of course, in the time of Newt Gingrich, who, by the way, was at least consulting with, if not actively participating in, the transition team. The goal of Newt Gingrich was to defund public broadcasting and make it privatized. If Barney can make its living off of selling little stuffed dinosaur dolls, why can't Sesame Street do the same thing? Was his line. So that's one thing. Then you have the simple economics of running a station. The commercial broadcasters get all the money from political ads. So the political campaign season for them is a big cash register. Non-commercial radio is prohibited from taking political ads. And so even though non-commercial radio is doing the heavy lifting of actually educating the public about issues and candidates, they're not allowed to get any of the money from the campaign ads. So those kind of things. And then finally, some of the structural things that are going on in the media world with consolidation, the shrinking of the number of daily newspapers, the number of magazines, the number of radio station owners, has resulted in a lot of these cutbacks. So here in Madison, we saw 92.1, the self-named progressive radio station that was switched initially to Christmas music for a couple of weeks following the election, and now they're going over to some sort of top 40 music format. That for them is supposedly an economic decision, that they can sell more advertising around the less controversial subject matter. Similarly, Sly, who was doing a radio show on a station in western Wisconsin, was told that his program was too controversial and taken off the air. And then you have stations like WORT Community Radio, where I worked for many years, struggling to pay the bills with rising costs of health care, rising costs of electric utilities, telephone, all those things, and still trying to survive on the individual donations of listeners, many of whom are giving money to those PTA bake sales to buy books for their kids to be able to go to school, and they, you know, their capacity is decreasing. So all of these things go into play in terms of defunding progressive media. And at The Progressive magazine, we're definitely, you know, feeling that as well. We have we've seen a decline in subscribers over the years. We're looking to increase that, both through redesigning our website and doing more outreach in different ways. But I encourage all of you to take advantage of this little gift subscription page on your magazine and send The Progressive to friends that might not know about us already. The role of independent media is critical right now. And what we're seeing nationally is an attack on independent media, partly masquerading as an attack on fake news. And there have been several articles recently, most notably one in the Washington Post, accusing many independent news sources of actually being Russian propaganda. And I'm afraid that this fake news moniker is going to be used against so many independent media outlets in the coming years. And we've already heard Trump people saying that they're going to sue major media outlets that say bad things about him or portray him with a double chin. So I think that, you know, we're in for a rough ride in the media world.
We have a state governor who believes in doing anything he feels like and then going to the courts afterwards. Mm-hmm. So why should
Well, and in fact, that has been the modus operandi of the Trump organization for years, mm-hmm. is to do things, and that's why he's in so many different lawsuits over building codes and discrimination and his Trump University and so on, because they do things and then wait to get caught.
Mm-hmm. I have a question on the lawsuits. The one that I know about is Trump University, and he settled with that, but they were saying he had 70 others. Now, because he is going to be taking over as president in January, how are the other lawsuits against him, because he's going to be president, what do you think is going to happen with those?
Well, of course, he's giving the business away to his kids, right? So they'll have to deal with those.
Yeah, sure.
I think that his notion is that, you know, his companies are going to deal with those lawsuits as they have been, and all that stuff drags out for so many years. I don't think that there's any, that he has any concern about any of that reaching him. And many of the simple provisions of ethics law that apply to public officials don't apply to the president. There are some that still do, and so one can hope that he'll take that into account if he does in fact get inaugurated on January 20th, as I anticipate he will.
You've covered some pretty violent elections in South America. Have those included attacks on media that you could tell us about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's not unusual for the right to cry foul against independent media coverage or even critical media coverage by mainstream media in those countries. And you know, right now in Latin America, several countries are some of the most dangerous places to be a journalist, including Mexico, which has the highest number of journalists killed of any country in the world right now, higher than Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. Most of that related to the drug war and the drug cartels not wanting bad publicity. But in the cases of recently, I was in the elections in Honduras in 2013, and there was definitely a backlash against the press at that point following the victory of the right-wing candidate. And similarly in Mexico in 2006 and so on. It's, you know, it's a dangerous business being a reporter that's telling the truth when you have somebody who's built their career on not telling the truth, whipping up followers to attack them. And we saw that over and over again during this campaign where reporters were attacked at Trump rallies. So I would not be surprised if, you know, if things like that would continue.
There's an association of journalists that seeks to protect journalists.
Yeah, the Committee to Protect Journalists, I'm a member of that organization and works to support journalists that are under attack, both through various means of protection and also through working on legal structures. But it's, you know, mostly in response to incidents that take place. And so, you know, here I think what we're talking about today is in some ways how can we as citizens try and keep some of these incidents from taking place in the first place. And I'll finish up because we're just about out of time with something I just grabbed just as I was coming in. This is a something that just got written for The Baffler, which is a magazine that our own Pat Flynn, who used to be the art director of The Progressive, is now the art director of The Baffler. But the article is called A People's History of the Third Reich. And it looks at what it refers to as the mistake of simply saying, oh, Trump and all his folks are Nazis. It says, it's not to say that it wouldn't be irrelevant if Trump or Bannon or any incoming member of the Republican administration were actually neo-Nazis, although one suspects at this point that few Trump supporters would actually care. But the efforts to divine the darkest thoughts of their souls and then compare them to various Nazi leaders miss the point in an extraordinarily American way. And it goes on to talk about the American obsession with the great man theory of history. But it concludes, it says, in America, we learn that Hitler and the Nazis committed the Holocaust in Germany. German children learn that they all participated in it because the Germans came to believe that acknowledging their collective culpability as individuals was the only way to prevent it from ever happening again. It's called A People's History of the Third Reich, and it's in the Baffler. It just came out yesterday. So.
Is the Baffler online?
The Baffler is online. TheBaffler.com. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Please do share The Progressive with your friends. As Bob mentioned, I'm also the co-editor of a book called Rebel Reporting, which is the work of a wonderful journalist by the name of John Ross, who passed away about 5 years ago. And it talks about doing the kind of journalism that matters. And so if anybody's interested, I did bring along some copies of those as well.
Thank you very much, Mark.